listening to Commerce Talk with Smart OSC. Hello, and welcome to the very first Commerce Talk with Smart OSC, a new podcast that's all about bringing together some of the brightest minds in e-commerce across Asia Pacific to riff on trending topics in the industry, share their knowledge, have a few laughs, and for you, our valued listener, to hopefully learn something that you can take away and put to good use in your business today. My name's Adrian Wakeham, Regional Manager for Australia and New Zealand at Smart OSC. I've been working in and around the retail and e-commerce industry in Australia since 2010, including 8 years with the leading industry news resource, Power Retail. Who is Smart OSC? 15 years in operation, we're an award-winning digital commerce agency of 850 experts across 7 countries, including Vietnam, Australia, Singapore, Japan, Thailand, the US and the UK. Deep experience across most enterprise platforms and technology stacks. Our customers choose us because we can solve complex implementations at scale, backed by more than 1,000 successfully launched projects. Please do hit us up on the website if you want to know more. Now, without further ado, let's get straight into our topic for today, the importance of personalization. And I'm very excited to welcome our two expert guests. Hayley Worley, the CEO and founder of The Sheet Society, who has managed to make buying bedsheets online exciting by helping to personalize the process, and Mark Bartzer, outsourced CMO and e-commerce marketing consultant who has a real passion for personalization and customer experience. Hello to you both.
Hey, Adrian, how are you?
I'm fantastic on this fine Friday afternoon. Please tell us a little bit about yourselves, your backgrounds and your businesses. Hayley, let's start with you and then we'll pop over to Mark.
Great. Yeah, I'm the CEO and founder of a business called The Sheet Society. So we sell bedding and sheets online. And I guess the difference about our products is that we sell them all as separate. So you don't have to buy a set of sheets. You're kind of encouraged to mix and match different sizes, different colors, different fabrics to find the bed that's uniquely yours. So we launched the business around 2017. And we've just had a really, really big year of growth. Obviously, with COVID and lockdowns, everyone's staying home and focusing on spending more time in their bedrooms. So, yeah, we've grown to about a team of around 50 people in 4 years. So, yeah, it's been a wild ride so far, but really enjoying it.
Awesome. Fantastic. And Mark?
Hey, Adrian. Given a Friday afternoon, we really should have planned this in advance and kind of had some sort of drink policy, but it's a bit too late for that now, isn't it? So my name is Mark Bartzer. I'm in Sydney, Australia, and I work as kind of a consulting CMO, e-commerce consultant, mostly working with digitally led businesses, helping with kind of strategic growth planning and user experience and exploiting data and personalization and all those sorts of things are certainly areas I've spent a lot of time on and am quite passionate about. So it's a really cool subject today.
Oh, brilliant. No, thank you very much. Let's kick straight off with one example of personalization. So I want to first mention Rihanna. Now, most people are probably going to recognize Rihanna for her music, but most of her net worth, which is currently sitting around the $1.7 billion US mark, is due to her online cosmetics company, Fenty Beauty. Now, the key to Fenty's success has been their focus on inclusivity as a unique selling point. Rihanna, like all entrepreneurs, she saw a gap in the market, in her case, which was to launch a makeup line, which was focusing on a wide range of traditionally harder to match skin tones. You know, creating formulas that work for all skin types, pinpointing universal shades, that sort of thing. And the website itself allows customers to find their shade, visualize how it looks on them via a live self-portrait, and even book in virtual consultations. Now, I have to admit, I'm not in Fenty's target demographic, but I did have a play with the shade finder and the virtual try-on without creating an account. And for anyone who's interested, incidentally, my foundation shade is 370. I'm a medium deep with warm golden undertones. Now, personalization can take a number of different forms. And I noticed that the site doesn't have some of the more sophisticated personalization features switched on. For example, you know, when I closed the browser and came back without clearing cookies or being in incognito mode, I wasn't being presented with the imagery of the products I just looked at or having those presented to me in the shade that I'd actually been recommended. I will caveat that, however, that the homepage itself trades very much on Rhianna herself as the brand and also as the model for using the products. Hayley and Mark, now, if either of you do want to wax lyrical at this stage about your favorite Rhianna tracks, again, it's Friday afternoon, so probably no one's going to complain. But yeah, please do also tell us, you know, what are some of your initial comments on that Fenty site from a personalization standpoint?
Adrian, when you say you're not in the right demographic, I assume that's because you have like your perfect porcelain skin, so you just don't need any foundation. Is that kind of what you meant when you said you're not in the demographic?
Look, you know, maybe to frighten people afterwards on our socials, we'll put a photo up of the screen grab of me with my recommended foundation shade. It makes me look a bit like Mike Myers from the Halloween films, but yeah, we can put that up afterwards for anyone who really wants to go in there. But yeah, most of my Fenty knowledge actually came from talking with my almost 19-year-old daughter, who said, "Oh, Dad, Fenty was the first cosmetics brand I ever bought." So yeah, I was very well put in my place.
Yeah, I went through and tried it again. I'm a 180, so I'm a little bit paler than you, I guess. I think that's how, but I don't have numbers work. Maybe I'm darker, I don't know. But yeah, I think what's going back to Rhianna again, needed me, definitely number one. But you haven't said your favorite yet, Adrian. Your favorite Rhianna track?
My favorite Rhianna track. I'm gonna go crate digging here, and I'm still an umbrella fan. I do live in Melbourne and it is raining.
That's a classic. It's a classic. Cool.
It is a good one.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think with personalization, it's kind of interesting the way you're talking about it, Adrian. So you're talking about, you know, we go through this. I thought it was I did it and I got the picture up and made me look creepy or whatever. But it was a really good experience. And I think that the way they'd structured, for people who haven't done it, you go to, I think it's fentybeauty.com, and they ask you a number of questions, but it's like really kind of relatively easy answer to questions, but quite insightful. I think, you know, what color do your veins look like under your wrists and stuff like that. So I thought that was really well done. They had the balance between kind of nuance without kind of being overwhelming or asking really difficult questions. And so I thought it was really nice. But then, I guess when we talk about personalization, it's two broad buckets. There's explicit personalization when the user's like actively participating in it, which is, you know, the Fenty experience or the Sheet Society experience. And then there's implicit personalization, which is what you were speaking about, Adrian, you know, when you went back to the homepage again and I did the same thing as you and had the same experience, you know, it didn't say, hey, here's shade 180, do you want to buy it? Or it didn't show me pictures of models who with a similar skin tone to me, or that, and that's what I mean by implicit personalization. And I haven't seen any kind of Facebook, Instagram kind of remarketing ads for it. But you know, in a perfect world, you know, there was one particular model I chose as the one closest to me at the end of the process, and it would be great to show that model in the ads to me because they know my skin tone now. They know what I look like. And so that's a really great implicit signal. So there's kind of both sides of it. And I probably spend more time on the implicit rather than the explicit, as in, you know, how do we get the signals that users have given us? I actually did a training session earlier this week where I went through a marketing team and came up with a list of every single customer signal, every signal our customers were giving us. And it was a long list. Yeah. And then the second half of it was, and how do we get that data and how can we use it? And we're actually working on implementing that. So there's the explicit and the implicit, and they're very different things, but both powerful in very different ways.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and I guess if you're sort of stepping it back a little bit further, and I'm also keen to get your feeling on this as well, Hayley, is, you know, what, I mean, when you're talking e-commerce, I mean, what does personalization mean to both of you? You know, I mean, quite specifically, do you actually have a definition that you go by?
Look, not really. And I think at the core of personalization, it just has to feel like you've got something that you genuinely wanted. And I think it can come as simple as the product offering that you're selling. It doesn't have to be, you know, your name embroidered on something that's unique every time. I feel like if a customer comes to a website and says, hey, you've got exactly what I'm looking for, I'm thrilled with this, that to me is a personalized service at the core of it.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree. But there are many types. Yeah, I gave kind of implicit and explicit, but they're, you're right. You know, there's nuances within that because, you know, in the Sheet Society, you know, you can choose your own set, but you know, if you had to have monogram sheets or whatever, then that's again another type of personalization. Or it's still in the explicit bucket, but it's another one again. So yeah, but there's many, many different types.
Yeah. And speaking of your own, you know, and your own online shopping experiences, I mean, how much of a difference does that personalized experience make for you in general, or is it something that you really tend to look for depending on what you're actually buying?
Yeah, for me, it depends on what I'm shopping for. I think you can almost get quite gimmicky with levels of personalization. You know, there's a few wine brands out there that will go through a questionnaire, like, what do you like to do on the weekend? What's your favorite movie? And then, you know, recommend a wine to you at the end. And I think those experiences might just be for engagement purposes, not necessarily personalization experience. Mm-hmm. So for me, it needs to be really practical. And it needs to actually solve the job of what it needs to be done. And, you know, we've got a bed builder on our website where you can physically, you know, see the bed coming to life with the different colours and the different sizes and the different items that you're adding into that. And that to us serves that core function. We brought that further into augmented reality. And that for us was just a little bit of fun. And so you can get what you need on that 2D version, but if you wanted to play around with it a little bit more, there's that extra option. So for me, it's about finding that right balance between gimmicky and really worth your time to answer those questions or build out what you like.
Mm-hmm. And I'd agree with that, but also I think often, you know, I'm just getting to the explicit versus implicit, but the best personalization can often be the ones you don't notice. You know, like I was chatting with the CMO of, I probably shouldn't mention who, but like a large online kind of, I guess, lifestyle fashion retailer, and you know, and they have a very large catalog, and he was saying, you know, discovery is their biggest challenge. But you know, if you've got, like, you know, let's say, I don't know, 50,000 items, you know, 50,000 SKUs in stock, how do you help people discover the right one? And that's a lot of that's a personalization challenge. And they actually had like a team of data scientists working on that, trying to figure out how do we expose that. And that comes down to even, you know, pretty much every visual merchandising tool on the market these days, be it Search Spring or whatever, you know, Clever, all those tools, but they all have some sort of degree of personalized versus visual merchandising functionality. And that's, you know, that's really important for some stores. You know, particularly if you have a large SKU count, and that's the type of personalization that creates a really customized experience, but the user is probably mostly or largely or completely unaware that is going on.
Yeah, so that you know, and looking, and I guess where we sort of, you know, swing a little bit in terms of how you're actually going about providing that personalized experience, and you started to, you touched on it before, Hayley, in terms of the type of data that, you know, that is being collected, by the retailer in their digital experience, you know, and how are you bridging that between what's for engagement, what's generally going to personalize the experience. So in the case of the Sheet Society, I mean, what type of data and how much are you thinking that are you seeing that you need to be able to provide that personalized service? You know, do you think you have it pretty much right now, or where do you potentially see yourself needing to go over the next 12, 18 months or so?
That's an interesting question. I would say that we aren't utilizing our data well enough. I mean, we've got really good purchasing history, and if you look at our product, we've got 22 different colors in our collection, and we can see what customer age groups are purchasing what types of colors and what combinations, and we haven't even scratch the surface of, I guess, recommending different colours or different combinations to our existing customer base. We just haven't had the scope to do that at this stage. So I guess phase one was just offering that level of customization at the front end, which is our bed builder. And then phase two, we'll really start to dig into the data and go into like recommended items. We'll have specific, I guess, email flows and things like that.
Okay. Yeah. And again, and how are you going about gathering that data now? Like, is there, you know, I mean, obviously there's been some massive changes around privacy with various external
Yes.
Factors at the moment. You know, there's, I mean, where are you seeing, and let's talk about, before I go to Mark to sort of talk a bit more generally, let's talk about you and the Sheet Society community, you know, for now, is where are you drawing the line in what you think your customer base would be comfortable with?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, isn't it? Especially with the new iOS updates. How we're kind of, I guess, mitigating the risk of that and not having all of that, I guess, trackable data for our remarketing list is really playing into brand a lot more. And we know that by providing a really great brand experience, regardless if we can, you know, track them all over the internet until they come back to our website, we're working on getting them back that way because they want to, not because they've seen a million ads and we're forced them back to. So I guess that's how we're kind of mitigating that privacy data in terms of the iOS updates. But then I guess the data from our shoppers, that's something that we own. So we're easily able to leverage that. So I don't see that as a privacy issue at all, really.
Yeah, and look, and I think, and you also mentioned it as well before, even with the augmented reality piece, you've got that's as much about bringing people into how you're trying to present as a brand. It's a bit more fun, it's a bit more playful, and it's getting the, you know, which certainly from my experience of you and your brand, as limited as what it is, comes across quite, and that comes across, you know, quite well, I think, in your own personality.
Yeah. And like, we're grateful for that update, for making us, you know, refocus back on brand and not get so complacent and accepting of, you know, the algorithm going out to get those conversion for us.
Magic. Mark, any particular use cases that you wanted to talk to around that?
I mean, just flicking back to what Hayley said, I mean, I totally agree, but people can go too far down the personalization route, and I see particularly, you know, the kind of the young digital marketing manager type people, that they're just audience, targeting, which is great. And that can be very powerful, but they kind of don't think about brand. They don't think about experience. They don't think about, you know, how can we create something that's so compelling they don't need to be remarketed to, which is, I think, what you're talking about, Hayley. And iOS 14 was great. It's made a lot of my work easier, to be honest, in some ways. Because it's stuff I was talking about before iOS 14, but now that some of that data flow has been cut off. Anyway, that's probably a whole other podcast in there. But yeah, use cases, and Hayley, you briefly touched on that where you mentioned email, and we've kind of been talking mostly about, you know, website personalization so far, but it's about, you know, looking at all the different touch points that you with this online centric view here, you know, you've got the website, but you've got email, you've got Facebook ads, you've got Google ads. And then even within the website, you know, you've got many different types. You've got, you know, what content you have on your homepage, you know, how's your IA structured, what recommendations you're making, what's your visual merchandising. These are all things that can be personalized and all things that can be tailored. And they each one of them has kind of its own unique challenge. So it's really about trying to create that experience across all touch points. So talking about use cases, Adrian, you know, it's like when I had that session, when was on Wednesday, I think it was this week. It's for a furniture company, and you know, so one of the things they have on their site is the ability to browse by room. You know, so you want to look at furniture for by room. It's one of the ways we've organized. It's part of some user research I did a while ago, but said people want to organize, search by room. And so let's go and say you go onto this website and you go and go to the room part of the navigation, you choose bedroom. Okay, what's happened is, even though you're not logged in, we don't know who you are, we suddenly know you're interested in bedrooms. And, you know, you're probably redecorating a bedroom, doing something like that. You know, we can make assumptions at this point. And so next time you come back to the website, instead of, you know, on the homepage, we have, you know, whatever latest springs, you know, our springs, you know, special collection or whatever, we can have a, you know, top tips for personal, for styling a bedroom or something like that. And that's something that's, again, you know, but the user wouldn't notice that, but that's going to be more engaging. So that's for sort of use cases. It's like, how can we meet people where they're at and creating that experience? You know, you wouldn't walk into a physical shop and saying, you know, I'm interested in bedroom stuff, and the salesperson's not going to say, here's our sale, which has nothing to do with bedrooms. You know, you wouldn't have it in the shop. Why do we do that online? But we do all the time. We've got the signals. We're just not using them.
Okay. Yeah. Look, you know, and I think certainly based on what you've been talking about already, Mark, is a lot of this comes down into what would just be considered what are good baseline practices to have in place anyway, and then you build on top of that. And you know, and I think there's been plenty of humorous little skits made over the course of the last 15 years that really do call out almost some of the ridiculousness that happens with some of the stuff that happens buying online that you would not experience in a real life situation. So
yeah,
I think it's yeah I
interesting. Think, it's talking interesting talking about real life situations because I'm actually experiencing the opposite problem. You know, we're looking to open stores, but how do I use personalization to tell the person who's walked into the store everything that I want them to know about the brand? And whereas I can do that through marketing funnels and retargeting and, you know, getting them to watch different videos at different times. So, yeah, I'm struggling to personalize their offline experience.
Okay. There's potentially another podcast topic for us again, Mark. to have another one, and I think it is really good, and I think you make a really really good point there too, Hayley. I went through this a couple of years ago actually buying a television, and I thought it was a really the online part of the experience because I still wanted to, you know, and I was given the option to actually reserve the TV and then actually go into a store and look at it and before I wanted to actually buy it, and that. All the online part of the process was absolutely perfect, but when I got to the store, the moment they heard I'd made that I'd reserved it online, they really couldn't care less when I was actually in the store. And I actually needed to buy some other stuff to be able to install this thing. And even down to the point is it wasn't until after I'd checked out and gone around to pick up the device, and the guy in the warehouse took one look at my car and said it won't fit in there. You're gonna have to get a truck. You're gonna have to order a truck, or you're gonna have to get it delivered. And it's like, oh, can you organize that for me? No, you're gonna have to go back into the store and organize it. And that was that actually ruined the experience. Where you would think that was a prime opportunity for them to be able to sell me cables, and actually find out while I was actually in the store with the salesperson. This is where else we can help enhance that experience, because you've got the TV. Have you got the other things you need? So I think we can always get better. I think everyone can always improve. So
I'm guessing some perverse commission structures in place there. That's what it sounds like. Is that what presents you got, Adrian?
Yeah, very much so. I won't, again, to protect the not so innocent, I won't mention the brand here. It turned what had started off as an amazing experience into a very poor one.
Yeah. That doesn't surprise me. I've heard very, very, very similar stories.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess off the back of that, you know, let's talk a bit, you know, obviously we've been talking about, you know, how the Sheet Society does this. We've talked about Fenty a little bit. Let's talk about some other examples and you know, specific personalization features. If, you know, are there any particular examples of brands who both of you think do this really really well outside of your own immediate businesses? And that's taking in sort of what Mark was suggesting. You know, personalization isn't just the website; it's what's happening offsite as well. Is there anyone that either of you want to particularly call out as being the flag bearers?
Yeah, something we're looking into at the moment is the concept of kind of guided selling. And I guess that's personalization, probably a really obvious form of personalization. So, you know, brand like Warby Parker, you can go onto their website and you can, you know, select your frame, select your lenses, and then see that on your real face. So I don't know, it's an interesting concept to me, because I don't feel like every customer wants to shop like that. But for the ones that do, I can see that being really valuable. So yeah, that's just an interesting, I guess, path that we're looking down at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, how are you thinking you could apply that into the Sheet Society? Because being a spectacles wearer, that is actually now something I actually look for that try-on feature if I'm checking out frames.
Yeah, I mean, for us, it could be, you come online, okay, hey, what fabric do you want? Do you want cotton or linen? What kind of color tones do you have in your bedroom? Is it more neutrals or is it more grays? And then we're kind of just using a process of elimination. You know, do you have a flat sheet? How many pillows do you have on your bed? And then you kind of get to the end of that selling process and it spits you out maybe a couple of options. I'm hesitant because that's not the way I shop for things. I like to look through every single page on every brand's website to make sure that I haven't missed anything.
Yep.
But I think there are both shoppers out there. So whilst personalization and certainly that guided selling sounds like a really good feature, you need to, I guess, make sure it's right for your demographic and potentially offer a few different ways of being sold to online.
What are your thoughts on that, Mark, in particular? And I mean, because, you know, certainly what I'm personally seeing around guided selling is again, how can they try and replicate the service that you would get from dealing with a salesperson in a physical environment? That's kind of where I see some of the guided selling technologies that are out there are trying to replicate. I mean, where are you seeing that sort of fit?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm seeing, and I'm guessing, Hayley, you're probably talking about Prezi or equivalent technology, I'm guessing. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I know Michael, who runs Prezi very well, and I know that was the inspiration behind the business, that he wanted to replicate that personal sales experience. And you know, Michael said that to me numerous times, and it's really cool. But it's not for everyone. You're right, and that's the thing. You know, people think there is a path to purchase, and there's not. But there's multiple paths to purchases, and I think you'll find, Hayley, your experience, and I've done kind of research in this in the past, where people don't like, you know, people don't like having their options narrowed or like to be very explicit about how they narrow the options. That's quite common. But people want to see all the options available to them. But again, that's, you know, and I know I keep coming back to this, but that's where implicit personalization comes in, where you can, you know, do stuff like visual merchandising, for example, where you're guiding them towards the products you believe are most likely, but still giving them the option to do everything. Visual merchandising, you know, you still see every single product. It's just the ones we believe most likely to be suitable for you are shown first.
And I guess off the back of that, for someone who is potentially at the beginning of their journey with personalization, are there any features that you would say were probably the ones which are needed by most? What would be the ones you would start with from a personalization journey? If I can sort of make that a two part question.
Yeah, I mean, but people doing it well, I think if you're doing it really well, perhaps people don't even notice you're doing it. You know, you've got pretty obvious stuff. Like if you go to the eBay homepage, it'll just show you stuff that you've browsed. It seems to go back a long way. I reckon it showed me stuff I browsed a year ago or something. But that's very basic and very simplistic, and it's fine. I have a sneaking suspicion, and again, this is getting back to the, if it's done well, perhaps you don't even notice it, but I have a sneaking suspicion the Iconic are doing a lot in this space. I certainly know they have people working on it. I know that for a fact. I'm pretty sure they're doing some stuff, but maybe it's just for, you know, I see the stuff I like and I buy it. I don't know. It could be that simple.
I've got a great example of someone, I guess you could call them a competitor, who have probably missed the mark in terms of personalization, and they've built a similar bed builder to ours, and you kind of go through the motions, and then you've got this option to add a spare. They've got a bed builder, so you can visually see it, and you've got an option at the end there to add a spare fitted sheet or flat sheet, and it just plops on the floor because you've got already one on your bed. And I just think it's a really odd concept, because as soon as I saw that, I was kind of like, hang on, you're doing that for you, not for me. You want to sell me an extra one, and that I'm not benefiting at all from this. Visually, it's just sitting on the floor next to the bed. So I think the personalization has to be really genuine and really valuable to the customer. It should be really specific, and I think just that was a really good example of perhaps taking it a little bit too far and too pushy, maybe.
So
Yeah, okay. I mean, you've got some companies, you know, One Person, a Daily Editor, you know, being obvious examples, but also like up and comers like Citizen Wolf, who basically, but the fact that the product is personalized, if you don't know, Citizen Wolf is that they do primarily t-shirts, but they do them. Everyone is made for you based on, they've got like a pretty cool fitting tool. Really good, really, really nice shirts. And I'm not wearing one today. I was yesterday. And at that point it actually becomes like central to the company's brand. So that sort of personalization, you know, that is what Citizen Wolf do. They do personalized t-shirts, and, you know, the Sheet Society, you can buy kind of, you know, correct me wrong, Haley, but you know, you can go and buy, but personalization seems to be the way you certainly seem to be encouraging. I don't know how many people buy that way, what percentage of your customers are kind of personalizing there, but it seems to be kind of quite core to what you do. And that's like a really interesting value proposition, kind of, you know, operating that way. And I think that's resonating with a lot of people these days.
And I think it kind of goes on to maybe your previous question, Adrian, about, you know, what can we be doing as a business on the back end of that? And that example that you spoke about of a t-shirt that is your perfect size, you know, perhaps on the back end, they've actually already made a few sizes that they think are, you know, the most popular ones. And so you feel like you're getting that personalized experience by putting in your measurements, but really it might just be the equivalent of a size medium. And so I think it's an interesting concept to understand what's going on behind the personalization.
Yeah, I don't know. I suspect that they certainly make a song and dance about doing it all personalized, and it takes like, you know, 2 weeks or whatever. And it was quite interesting. I ordered two products, and when my parcel came, it was only one product. And I was like, oh, this is really annoying. And what had happened is that there was a little card in there saying, you know, because they're so passionate about sizing, getting a fit, they said, we've sent you your first product. Tell us if this fits well. And if it does, then we'll send you your second product.
Yeah, ah. Great.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, which is kind of cool. But the actual CX around that was a bit poor, but they were working on that, and the value proposition was really good.
Yeah, well, that's cool. Yeah. I mean, and I think you've given that example there in terms of which is another end of personalization that, you know, that the likes of Flora and Fauna do really well and have done from day dot, is you personalize it right through to the actual handwritten card that's actually coming in the parcel, you know, which I think is again trying to extend that human touch, because the whole idea of personalization is make it personal, make it realize you're actually dealing with a human at the other end of the digital experience. So is that something again that you would suggest is a good thing to be considering as part of that personalization journey, or is potentially that even left as an afterthought for some brands where it's not an innate part of their DNA?
Yeah, we've sent personalized handwritten notes from day one, and we'll hopefully always continue to do that. You know, we've built in something to our shipping label that tells our packers how many orders that person's placed with us. And we can say things like, hey, you know, thanks for your first order. I hope you love getting in bed with us. Or we can say, hey, you're back again. I can't believe you've ordered 5 times. You know, this is a great combo, or, you know, mentioning, I guess, what they've purchased in the box. So yeah, that's an area of personalization that is just innate to our brand.
Oh, no, magic. Yeah. I'm gonna have to fix my guilt of not having bought from you before, Hayley, and make sure I do test on my buy linen.
I'm actually in the market for some sheets as well. I've been struggling to find some I like. But I investigated a project a while ago. I never got off the ground, unfortunately. And I'm not saying no one's doing this. I'm just saying I don't know anyone doing this. We were looking at to put, you know, when you get your delivery, you know, sheets or whatever it might be, I was looking to put in a flyer with personalized product recommendations. So it would actually be printed dynamically for that customer saying, hey, here's 10% off your next purchases. Here's 3 items we think you might like. I'm always disappointed I didn't give it off the ground, because I would have been really interested to see how that went.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the offers that I get in the stuff now, and it's the same thing every month from the same people. And ironically, in many cases, I'm given these X amount off my first order for things that I'm already buying.
Yeah, and by the time someone's made a purchase, you generally, in most stores, you know a fair bit about them. you know what they've been, obviously you know what they bought, but you also know their purchase, their path to that purchase, what else they looked at. And, you know, at the very least, you know, people who bought, you know, product X also often bought Y and Z. And so worst case, you just chuck that in. All the AI personalization tools, it's kind of a commodity these days, but but actually doing it in a physical flyer and dynamically printing it. But anyway, never happened. I'll pull it off one day.
Yeah, we'll be waiting to see it, Mark. And if anyone can pull it off, I'm sure you will.
I need some good dev support. If you know anyone, Adrian, let me know.
Yeah, mate. Let's talk offline. Yes, good. Cool. So I guess as a segue sort of into the more cautionary tale, and you mentioned it before, Hayley, in terms of it can be quite obvious where some of the things which are sort of put into some of these visualizations on the side are designed clearly just to try and upsell people with no real value to the user. Any other particular notes of caution or things that you think you should clearly not be doing as part of a personalization, as offering a more personalized experience? Anything like, you know, creepy, invasive,
balance. Yeah, I guess. It's only, I guess, a case of putting the customer first and understanding what their needs would be. When we launched the business back in 2017, I spoke about personalization being like innate to our brand and the ability to mix and match any color and any size. That functionality just was not possible on the free Shopify theme. And so looking at it from a customer's point of view, we needed to kind of, I guess, do whatever we had to on the back end to be able to build that into our site. So we did things like create custom SKUs for different order possibilities. We used like the three different variant options in Shopify. Mm-hmm. And we used them as kind of double queen and king. And then we had to create SKUs behind each possible configuration, if that makes sense. So like a double fitted, a king flat, and standard pillowcases, and every single configuration had a SKU in the back end that meant that our customers felt like they could choose anything possible. And, you know, it was an absolute nightmare for our systems. I think instead of having 30 SKUs, we had about 2,500 SKUs for every possible combination on that product page. But as a business, we were able to make the call and say, is this the right thing for the customer? And does this look better on the front end? And then let's do whatever we can on the back end. So it doesn't always have to be an expensive decision to go down the personalization route. And, you know, we spoke about Prezi before, and there are really great bundle apps and, a plethora of apps within the Shopify backend that you can use. So, yeah, thinking about it, how that would benefit the customer is really important.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, I'm going to steal one of your lines off you, Mark, in terms of, you know, where it comes around that cost benefit is almost all of these solutions, it's understanding where are you on the line of what the solutions are going to cost you to buy or build in the first place. And you can go from there. You can go from the tens of dollars a week to the hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And I guess it's understanding where on the line you're comfortable and where you're going to see the benefit from it. Would you suggest, and again, you know, Mark, obviously you're talking with a lot of brands day in, day out about this sort of thing. Are there scenarios or businesses for which you think going down a personalization path isn't going to be worth the outlay?
Look, I mentioned earlier, I'm sure there's some exception that I can't think of right now, but I think every business can benefit from it to some extent. But it's about, you know, it's cost benefit. And, you know, if you're doing $5 million a year revenue, you probably don't need very much personalization at all. I mean, not need, but the cost benefit's not going to be there. But if you're doing, you know, $500 million a year, then it's a very, very different story. And if you're not personalizing at that point, then I would question what you're doing. Actually, I can think of one company I'm working with who probably won't benefit that much from personalization, maybe. But they basically only sell one product, really. Yeah. One product to one demographic. It actually has its own unique challenges having only one product. I know it sounds very simple, Hayley, because most of my companies I work with have hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of products. Yeah. But yeah, one product is actually quite an interesting challenge.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, well, that's it. You know, and look, and obviously, Hayley, you outed someone before who you think was doing personalization wrong. Is there, again, without doing a call out for a name and shame, is there anyone else that you would like to that you'd like to suggest, or Mark? Like, what's an example of personalization done wrong in really wrong in your eyes?
Oh, I mean, I feel bad about adding someone. Lucky I didn't mention any names.
Come on, name them, Hayley. Name them.
I think that, I mean, certainly for us, when we built our AR functionality, that was just for us. That was for us giving it a go and pushing the boundaries. And I think that the lines could be a little bit blurred between, is this useful for the customer, or is this just something that we felt like we wanted to build as a brand? So I think that's probably a guardrail that where things probably could go wrong if your intentions aren't right on, is this going to benefit the customer? But I mean, having said that, you know, the AR functionality that we've built out is a really great tech feature, and although not many people use it, and it's certainly not really key to getting someone to convert on our website, it still really does play into our whole brand ethos.
Yeah, I mean, not directly answering your question, Adrian, but about things that do badly. You know, I talk to a lot of CRM people in my work, and, you know, obviously CRM is an area where personalization is a lot easier than other areas, because, you know, you have a lot of data and you have ability to execute on that data through whatever email, you know, even the most basic email marketing platforms allow basic personalization, right? Mm-hmm. You can even MailChimp, you can personalize in that. And as you move up, it gets more and more sophisticated. But what really drives me nuts is to talk to CRM people, and you say, okay, so if you want to start doing personalization, like, this isn't a job interview. I've been hiring several CRM people for a few companies recently. You say you want to we want to get more data so we can offer better personalization segmentation. And their answer is usually a preference center, which is where you get people to say, this is what I'm interested in. I'm interested in, you know, furniture for my bedroom, or I'm interested in, you know, furniture made of wool or something. And people don't know the answers to their questions, and they don't give good answers. And if you're really lucky, you're going to get 10% of your audience answering one of those preference centers, and you're going to get near enough to 0% keeping up to date. And it's just useless data, that stuff. Yeah. I'm really not a fan of it. I've never seen someone execute a preference center. Oh, once when I was at Microsoft years ago, we had a good preference center, but that's the only time I've ever seen it done well.
I've got a prime example of us doing personalization wrong. And we sent out a text last year before Black Friday, and obviously didn't get the first name field correct. And it sent to our database and it said, hey, first name in brackets. So I guess if you haven't executed it right, obviously it's going to go down like a ton of bricks, but then, you know, it was a branding opportunity for us to be able to follow up with another text that said, hey Sarah, of course we know your name, we've been sleeping together. So it was a really funny opportunity for us.
Google have got an entire page. I've actually got it up now. It's if you want to Google it, it's called personalized advertising. I'm going to Google, but it's basically a list of things you can't do in personalization, because, you know, the amount of stuff, you know, Google knows about you and what you send to Google is pretty creepy. So, you know, for example, while it's technically possible, their guidelines don't allow it. You know, you could show an ad that says, hey, you know, so someone Google Sheets and an ad could pop up that's saying, hey, you bought from the Sheet Society 3 months ago. Why are you not coming back to us again? You know, you can do that technically.
But that's, God.
A, Google won't allow it, and B, it's creepy as hell, and there's a good reason they don't allow it. I think they don't want the consumer backlash, much less, you know, many other good reasons for not doing it. I think I read an article a while ago that said, I'm just reading myself, as an industry, we have largely followed an unwritten don't be creepy rule for fear of killing the golden goose. Email marketers have known for decades that people would be up in arms if they found out how much we knew about them.
Yeah, yeah. Wasn't that a case study in the US a couple of years ago, I think, with the Target brand in the US? And there was teenage girl whose parents found out that she was pregnant because of a personalized email that was sent to her parent.
Kind of, yeah. I remember that case study. Yeah, she started getting catalogs with maternity gear in it, and they complained to her. I remember then the girl came out, you know, she did a pregnancy test 2 weeks later. I don't think she even knew at that point, but potentially.
Yeah.
I know the case study you're talking about.
Yeah. I remember the shock and awe at which I read that, saying, oh, wow, that is creepy. But I think at the time, that was where, you know, that was where these types of tools were really only starting to become fairly widely known to both consumers, even though a lot of marketers had known they had this power for a while.
Yeah, and there's still so much that can be done in this space, and pretty much every company I know of, including ones I'm advising, are only scratching the surface of it. Where you know, for most companies, not all, you know, there's a range of products, and just not every customer is interested in every product, you know, and so that's where you get into whether it be, you know, a more traditional segmentation, or whether it's AI driven, which is, I'm a big fan of AI, but it can be overrated sometimes. Dealing with a company that sells kind of hair and beauty products, and you know, if someone goes and browses a product, you know, a shampoo for bleached hair, or you know, whatever, then we can probably put that person into the bleach blonde segment. And if we send them an email saying, hey, top 10 tips to keep your hair looking blonde in summer or whatever, that's going to get an amazing open rate.
Yeah.
But most companies aren't doing that sort of stuff.
No. And sorry, I've actually just thought of a really inappropriate email subject line to send to people in that segment as well, to say, your roots are showing, time to rebuy.
That'll piss a lot of women off.
Yes, it will. That's why I said it was incredibly inappropriate.
Yes. So, did you spill Vegemite in your hair? Or is it just... Oh man, we could go so far with this one.
I might take this opportunity to actually wrap it up at this point. Really want to thank both of you for coming on the podcast. Definitely like to be able to throw back to you very quickly if there's anything that you want to plug about yourself, social media accounts, websites, the amazing spring offers that the Sheet Society might have. Hint, hint. please do plug away. And if people want to get in touch with you, how they can do it.
Thank you, Adrian. It's been a really great conversation. Some really interesting topics. So you can just check out the Sheet Society at thesheetsociety.com. And we'll start following us on Instagram, and our little algorithm will follow you back. But if anyone wants to reach out to me, I'm just on LinkedIn too. So Hayley Wally, happy to have a chat with anyone.
Yep. And Mark Bartzer, either markbartzer.com or LinkedIn is probably the best place to get me. I'm on LinkedIn far more than I care to admit.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much again, both. And to everyone out there in podcast listening land, thank you very much for listening. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast if you found it enjoyable. And you know what? Even if you didn't find it enjoyable, subscribe anyway. See if we can change your mind next time around. On whatever platform you're listening on, please rate and review the episode. Share it with anyone else you might think finds it interesting. For more on personalization and e-commerce, please do check out our website. And get in touch with anyone. But, you know, Mark and Hayley have made it quite keen to chat to anyone who wants to talk. And, of course, I will as well. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.